ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia.
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue, as we ask, do we still need the alliance? Search for Global Roaming on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Science Show, why optimists tend to live longer than Debbie Downers.
And how a brush with death led to a career studying water contamination.
Do you value viciousness over kindness in your friends? Find out why that's totally normal.
And hear from young scientists who are restoring and caring for our coastlines. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Robin, I love this time of year. We're just a few weeks from the Nobel Prizes, which means it's Ig Nobel Prize time.
It's fascinating that for the first time, as you're about to tell us, Mark Abrahams, the inventor of Igs, has decided to take his prizes away from America.
For the first time in 35 years of Ig's history, you're right. And he says it's because travel to the US is no longer safe. So the prizes this year were presented in Zurich on Thursday, and one of the winners of the Ig Nobel Peace Prize was Dr. Keela Williams. She's an evolutionary psychologist at Hamilton College in New York, but she was born here in Australia.
I was born in Wollongong, and I spent my early childhood on Norfolk Island.
How old were you when you moved off the island?
I was only 5 years old, which is why, as I'm sure you've noticed, I do not have an Australian accent.
No, you definitely do not. How's it feel to win an Ig Nobel Prize?
It was really exciting. I couldn't believe it when I got the phone call from Jamie Krems, who is the lead author on the paper that won the prize and also happens to be my best friend. So that was a very exciting moment for both of us.
Okay, that makes so much sense. Best friends working together in friendship research.
Yes, it's a perfect combination.
So you and your best mate and other colleagues as well, I don't know how close you are to them, but you won the prize for research into vicious friends. Why did you decide to look into this aspect of friendships?
Well, I think that many of us have heard of friendship preferences in that we want our friends to be kind and helpful and generous and just overall lovely people. But at the same time, we also have friends who would happily stab our ex in the eye if they had the chance. And so how can we reconcile these two things? So, you know, we have these close friends who are also a little bit vicious. And so the research was really trying to understand that difference.
How do you understand that difference?
So I think that what is missing from the existing literature that talks about friendship preferences is that when we say that we want friends who are kind and generous and helpful and trustworthy, what we really mean is that we want friends who are all of those things to us, not necessarily towards other people, especially people we don't like.
Sort of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Exactly.
In a sense.
Exactly.
And so in your work, what did you find? Is there such a thing as a too vicious friend? Like you were talking about stabbing someone in the eye. Pretty vicious.
Well, you definitely want the viciousness directed outwards towards people you don't like. You don't want people who are indiscriminately vicious. And you certainly don't want to be the target of that viciousness, your own self. The way that we did our study was we asked participants in the United States and in India how kind or vicious they would want a friend to be towards either themselves or a stranger or an enemy. And we described an enemy as someone who is competitive with you, someone who's mean to you, or someone who would be happy to see you fail. And then what we found was that people want their friends to be more trustworthy and kinder to them than they are to strangers, and to actually be more vicious than kind towards their enemies.
You're an evolutionary psychologist. How does this quality of friendship fit into our evolutionary history?
There is an evolutionary psychology of friendship preferences that starts from the reality that we are limited in the number of friendships that we can maintain at any given time. And that's because our time and our energy are finite. So we can't have as many friends as we want to. We actually have to pick and choose who we're spending our time with. And we want to do that in a way that's going to maximize the benefits to us. So there are all these people out there and they have different qualities and traits. And we are inclined towards friends who possess the qualities and traits that are going to be most beneficial for us.
And it makes perfect sense, but sometimes you just need these things spelled out to be like, oh yeah, of course. And it made me think about my friendships. Do you view your friendships through a different lens now?
I definitely do view my friendships differently from doing this research. This research is part of a broader area of research that's into what my friend, Jamie Crumbs, has called the embedded dyad framework. And that's basically the idea that friendship pairs don't exist in a vacuum. They are embedded in a broader network of people. And that has implications because it means that our friends are interacting with people aside from just us. And those interactions can have implications for our own outcomes. And I think this is a really powerful idea that people haven't been thinking about or talking about. Instead, we tend to think of friendships as just a pair of people and not everyone who is also potentially influencing those friendships. And so thinking about that has definitely changed the way that I consider my own friendships.
Do you and Jamie spend time slagging off your enemies, your academic nemeses on a regular basis now to really cement that friendship?
Absolutely. There's nothing better for bonding than shit talking, right?
Amen, sister, 100%.
I would say another really interesting implication of the embedded dyad framework that I have done some research with again, Jamie Crumbs, is about friendship jealousy.
Please, so, yes.
This is always a fun topic to talk about. We're very familiar with the idea of jealousy in romantic relationships, where there is some third-party interloper who is trying to disrupt your valued romantic relationship. What we don't think and talk as much about is that in a friendship context of someone who is trying to poach our friend away from us. And yet this actually happens. And if you talk to people about it, they find it very relatable of, oh yeah, I remember when I, you know, saw someone getting close with my friend and it made me feel jealous. So we have a line of research that is looking at that. And the main takeaways that I would say that are there are that, first of all, we don't get jealous when it's a new romantic partner with our friend. And that's because they're not fulfilling the same role that we do. So we don't feel as threatened. And then the other main takeaway is that it's not about how much time you spend with someone, because we spend a lot of time with coworkers, for example, but we don't feel the same level of jealousy about our friends spending time with their coworkers. And so it's not just about amount of time, it's the threat of replacement. Do we feel like this person is going to steal our spot in our friend's affection?
Yeah, that's a good one. Again, thinking about my friendships. How do you study jealousy in friendships?
So you can study it by simply asking people to retrospectively remember a time that they felt jealous and then do a sort of qualitative analysis of what the circumstances were that that happened under. You can also induce jealousy. So you can ask people to imagine a scenario that you are trying to prompt them into feeling friendship jealousy and then see how they respond in various ways. And in one study that we did in that first paper that I think you'll get a kick out of was we were asking participants to pretend that they were in charge of seating at a dinner party. And they had their best friend and they couldn't be at the dinner party, but they were going to choose the seating for everyone else. And so their best friend was going to be there. And their best friend was becoming close with this other person. How far away do you seat them at the table? And what we found is that if you're feeling friendship jealousy, you seat the person farther away.
Of course.
So that, you know, they can interact or talk with your best friend.
Put them just on the absolute diagonal opposite corner as your friend. Mathematically, could not be further apart.
Exactly.
What else are you working on at the moment?
So I have a line of research that is also about friendship preferences, but is more focused on trying to understand the differences between what men and women prefer in their friends. And so I have a paper that was just published recently that was looking at how men and women prioritize emotional support in their friendships. What I found in that research was in the UK, Australia, the United States, and China, women rated emotional support as more important in their friendships than men did. But emotional support comes in lots of different forms. The one that probably most immediately comes to most people's mind is validation, where I tell you, oh, that must be so hard. I'm so sorry you're going through this. And it's very talking-based and feelings-based. And that, I think, is what people were imagining when we're asked about emotional support. But it could also take the form of more action-oriented things like giving advice or providing distractions to someone who's having a hard time. And so what I suspect is that if you define emotional support in those more action-oriented ways, that the gender difference is going to disappear. Friendships are such an incredibly critical part of our lives. And I think that they have been understudied in science and also underappreciated just in everyday life. But we're finding more and more evidence about how important they are for health, happiness, and well-being. There's an often quoted statistic about how having no friends is as bad for your health as smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day. So I think that anything that we can learn about how friendship works and how to maximize it in our lives is going to be a really worthwhile endeavor.
Mm. Well, good luck with that endeavor. And thank you so much, Keela, for chatting to me about your work.
Thank you so much.
I know you only spent a few years down here, but we will claim you.
Much of my family still lives in Australia, and so I still feel a very strong connection.
Dr. Keela Williams, an evolutionary psychologist at Hamilton College in New York and newly minted Ig Nobel Peace Prize winner. The Ig Nobels weren't the only prizes handed out in the past week. The Australian Museum's Eureka Prizes were also awarded on Thursday evening, and these are kind of like Australia's science Oscars. This year, the prize for promoting understanding of science went to Dr. Leela Landowski. She's a lot of things. She's a science communicator who fights misinformation online with the World Health Organization. She's an ex-ABC Science Top Fiver.
And I'm a neuroscientist and senior lecturer at the University of Tasmania and a director of Science and Technology Australia and an executive director of the Australian Brain Alliance.
And along with all of those titles, are you also an optimist?
Very much so, which is great because optimists live longer and that means things are looking good for me.
The world's first double centurion. Well, it's funny because we talk about mindsets and overthinking positively and just expecting things are going to happen. And I'm on social media, I see influencers pop up all the time, spruiking, you know, manifesting, and I, you know, I roll my eyes and scroll past.
Yeah.
But is there any science behind this?
Well, that's a really interesting one. I mean, you certainly can't just, you know, manifest $1,000 and then it appears in your bank account. It doesn't work that way. But you can change the outcome of something, maybe not in the way you think, though. So you've probably heard of the placebo effect, which is when someone seems to sort of improve when they're given a dummy treatment. Now, the equivalent of that, which is not about drugs, is actually what we call belief effect. So when you think something, it's more likely to occur. But what is actually happening in that scenario is that when you believe something, then your body starts to respond as if it was true. And your brain's also doing these sort of complex calculations to help you decide whether it's likely to happen. Because the brain's basically an amazing pattern predicting machine. And so when it's predicting a good outcome, then it's essentially changing your physiology in subtle ways that allows you to be in a position, essentially physiologically, in a good position to perform better and for things to occur as you want them to.
So what kinds of things can this effect happen with? Like you said, you know, you can't just manifest $1,000 in your bank account. What could you potentially influence with positive thinking?
The pain story, I think, is a really interesting one, and that's where a lot of this evidence really lies. So when you're anticipating pain relief, for example, it's going to change how much pain relief you actually receive. Let's think of this case example. So they had a bunch of patients. Some of them received morphine and knew at the time that they were receiving morphine, and the other ones were receiving morphine but didn't know in that moment that they were receiving the morphine. And the people who knew that they were receiving it had much better pain relief as a result. And the flip side, of course, is true as well. So when you think that you're going to have a bad result or you're going to be in pain, then your response to that is increased as well. So you actually feel more pain in response to a certain stimulus.
Right. Is that the nocebo effect?
Yes, the nocebo effect, yeah. But certainly it's not just that. It's how you respond to stress. It's how your body responds to the food that you've eaten. It's how your body responds to the exercise that you might have done. It's really quite incredible if you think about it. So let me give an example. So let's say you're going into a really difficult meeting and your stomach's doing somersaults and your heart is racing and your palms are sweaty. And we often tell ourselves that that means that we're not coping with the situation. Mm. But the reality is that that is a normal physiological response. That is our body's stress response, basically increasing, making your airways dilate so more oxygen gets in, your heart rate is going faster so more blood is getting to the parts of your body and your brain that needs that energy. And that is allowing you to reach peak performance. But when we tell ourselves that that's a bad sign, then we tend to release a little bit more of these stress hormones, and we actually get tipped into this anxiety and panic. So really, these stress hormones work in a window of optimal levels. And so if you have too little, then you underperform. If you have the right amount, then you're kind of in the flow zone, everything goes well, perform really well. And if you have too much, that's when you tip into anxiety, you panic, maybe you forget what to say, or you say the wrong thing, or you just kind of give off a vibe that you're not competent in that scenario, or you might miss the easy shot if you're playing a sport. So when we tell ourselves that we're not going to do well in that meeting, when we're probably going to be releasing more of those hormones and therefore effectively be more anxious and then perform worse.
Can you just walk me through the steps from the cognitive side? Maybe you're talking to yourself in your head negatively about this upcoming meeting you're really stressed out about. What's the jump from brain to the hormonal response?
Well, think about it like this. So when we're telling ourselves like a story or a plan about how something is going to go tomorrow, we're basically making up a story. And we're pretending and we're assuming that it's true. You know, we're telling us all the ways that meeting is going to go badly. And so you're setting up yourself to release more of these stress hormones. So particularly your amygdala, which is your emotion processing and your essentially the panic button center of your brain, it's involved in fear, it's going to end up releasing more of these stress hormones and triggering that fight or flight response. And therefore you're more likely to perform worse. But you know, the thing is, it's a made up story and you're pretending that it's true. So why don't you just tell yourself the happy ending? Because if you tell yourself that it's going to be good, you're going to be more optimistic, you're going to be more confident, and you're more likely to have the balance of those neurochemicals and those hormones that will ultimately set you up for success.
What other areas does this seem to have, you know, some effect? We're not saying that it's going to work 100% of the time.
No.
But where is the evidence?
The studies that have looked at this, they're not big, massive studies, and the effect size can be modest. But if it's something that costs you nothing, if it's just the way that you think, then it's an important thing to think about, really. So another example is, this is actually my favourite one, it's called the milkshake study. It was done in 2011, and what they basically did is they had a bunch of people and they gave them a chocolate milkshake, and they told one group, you know, this is like a low-calorie milkshake, it's only got like 140 calories, it's very sensible and nutritious, and they told the other group that this is a really high-calorie, like 620-calorie indulgent chocolate milkshake. It was the same milkshake, but their bodies responded differently based on what they thought it was.
Really?
Okay.
How so?
So they released different amounts of the hormone ghrelin, which is involved in your feeling of fullness. The people who thought it was a high-calorie indulgent shake released less of this ghrelin and felt fuller for longer. And I think that is so fascinating because, to me, is kind of a pivotal study and a pivotal example because it shows that what you think actually changes these hormones at a physiological level, even if it's subtle, but it has meaningful effects on how you feel. You know, in this case, they felt fuller for longer.
You mentioned at the start that optimists tend to live longer.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Well, there's a few things at play here, but if you think about it, if you're always optimistic about things, then you're going to have less of that stress response chronically activated. So we know that higher levels of stress hormones are linked to things like cardiovascular disease, metabolic disease. So of course you're going to have higher incidences of strokes or heart attacks. It also precipitates or increases your risk of having any underlying mental health condition becoming worse. We know that, for example, physically shrinks the size of your hippocampus, so you have a harder time learning and remembering things. We know that chronic stress will also increase the size of your amygdala over time.
Hmm.
And the interesting thing is that your amygdala, whether you're a rat or a monkey or a human, the bigger that amygdala is, it's associated with more aggression. And the reason,
and the reason
why that happens is when you're using your amygdala more, it has to increase its activity, it makes these new connections, it becomes physically bigger because it's preparing you to then deal with the next challenge because you're already in this high stress state. And that has consequences for how we behave. We're more likely to be more aggressive, more defensive. And so that's why you might have an increased risk of, say, violence or crime. We also have this increased disconnection from our prefrontal cortex. Now, our prefrontal cortex is all about decision-making, problem-solving. We need it for our attention. And so, therefore, you're more likely, on average, to struggle with the job that you get, or you might have worse educational outcomes. There might be certain demographics, let's say low socioeconomic demographics. They, on average, have worse health outcomes. And we make an assumption that that's the case because, you know, wealthier people have more access to better healthcare, for example, and maybe they can make better decisions in their life, and that's why they're wealthy. But there's another flip side here, because when you are from a low socioeconomic background, you view the people around you as being more worthy, you're more disenfranchised, and that is a type of threat, a type of stress. It's called social threat. And social threat is a really interesting thing because it results in you releasing more of these stress hormones than usual. So let's say you're doing something that's sort of stressful, a difficult task, you release a certain amount of cortisol and other neuromodulators. If you're experiencing social threat, so you're feeling judged in that situation, or you're in the outside group, you know, you're the marginalized person in that scenario, you release about three times as much of that stress hormone cortisol. And I think it's just a really powerful reminder that certain demographics might have worse outcomes, but it's not their fault. They haven't chosen this. It's sort of a biological process. But if you're aware of it, then you can do something about it. That's what these belief effects is sort of really teaching us, that it's not just set in stone. If you change your mindset around something, if you change your perception of what that stress response is, then you're more likely to release the right amount of those stress hormones for you to perform well.
Mm.
And personally for me, this was a very useful thing for me to learn. So I come from a marginalised background. I grew up in the setting of alcoholism and domestic violence and being a carer for both of my parents from a young age. And I always had this absolute fear of public speaking. I'd just fall apart on the inside. Maybe people couldn't see it on the outside, but, you know, for days leading up to the public speaking event, I would just be a mess on the inside. I'd feel really sick. But learning about this, it made sense. It meant that my body was perceiving all of this as a social threat, and I was releasing huge amounts of these stress hormones, and therefore it was affecting my body and my response. But knowing that now, I remind myself that it's just a normal response, and I don't feel that nausea and anxiety and all of those symptoms in response to those situations. So I guess in myself, that's a case example of how you can use those belief effects to your advantage.
If someone's listening and they think, oh gosh, I'm a bit of a negative Nelly or part of minority group who might experience that social threat, how can you train yourself? Because if your default setting is I'm lesser than or, oh, this is a terrible situation, blah, 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 how do you snap out of that and keep that up? You can't just be an optimist every now and again. You want to make this a part of your personality or habit or something a bit more, you know, long-lasting.
That's the thing, is that the brain loves to change when it's something that you do repeatedly. So if you're always negative about everything, that way of thinking has become hardwired because you've strengthened those pathways associated with negative thinking. And the only way to overcome that is by consciously making yourself examine the positives. So think about how things are going to go well. And it's going to be awkward. It's going to be difficult at first. But ultimately, the more you do that, the more those pathways will become entrained. And then over time, you'll find yourself just naturally thinking of the positives. This is really why bad habits are so hard to break, because you've already rewired your brain to operate that way through repetition. But the reverse is true. So good habits come from repeating those things over and over again. So think about the positives in those situations, and over time, it'll become easier. And then over time, it's going to be like riding a bicycle. It's just going to happen autonomously. You don't have to think about pedaling and balancing.
Dr. Leela Landowski, a neuroscientist at the University of Tasmania and Eureka Prize winner. She was nominated for the Promoting Understanding of Science Award twice before this year, so maybe all that optimism has paid off. And this is a science show on ABC Radio National.
Wildfires in Europe so far this year have been vast and ferocious. The destruction and loss of life has been on a new scale in France, Spain, Greece, and even in Britain. So it's not surprising that scientists, as we reported last week, have been calling for a much increased preparation and study. An open letter published in the Australian Financial Review, signed by 67 top researchers in Australia, called on the federal government to tax 25% on gas exports to fund more R&D, research and development on fire. And one of those signatories was David Bowman, Professor of Pyrogeography at the University of Hobart. His expertise is Australia-wide, and I was impressed 10 years ago to see him at the Royal Society of London giving a keynote address to a packed international gathering of fire scientists. So has he been surprised by the sheer scale of the European Holocausts? And what are they doing in Tasmania to get ready for the likely burning challenges stoked by El Niño?
The project is trying to find a pathway for sustainable coexistence with wildfire. And what's really exciting is that the local insurer here in Tasmania, the RACT, have partnered with us, and they are now actually taking our research and wanting to see it applied in the field, in the wild. I think it's incredibly satisfying for an applied scientist to see your work being translated and implemented, and they're interested in the fact that they know they have an unsustainable exposure. The risk now for wildfire disasters is extraordinary, and Hobart is a particularly vulnerable place because in 1967 it had a very near miss. It's still one of the most severe bushfire disasters. 64 people were killed, but it could have been way, way worse. And now, because of the expansion of Hobart, coupled with climate change, so there's much more housing interspersed with bushland, we're getting more extreme, more frequent wildfire weather conditions. And we have had a run of really bad fire seasons, which have been interesting since the last 10 years, generally on the west of Tassie. We did have a very bad one in 2013, which destroyed the fishing village of Dunalley on the Tasman Peninsula. And that had a fire thunderstorm, the only known fire thunderstorm in Tasmanian history. But I feel our luck is running out. You drive down any major road, any major valley in Tasmania has been impacted by fires. And one of the things that's particularly concerning is that many of these very large fires have been caused by lightning storms, which seem to be getting bigger and more frequent. So it's not just about controlling human behaviour, it's also buckling up, I suppose, to the fact that the climate is now throwing more ignitions into the landscape. The landscapes are getting drier, fire weather is getting worse.
Let me just ask a question on that, because I last talked to you actually in the Royal Society of London 10 years ago, roughly, and I remember you made a few, not predictions, but observations about risk and so on. Now we're in 2026. Do you think you got the scenery right, or is it worse than you imagined?
Yeah, it's probably worse than I imagined. What was happening 10 years ago or more is fire scientists were very conscious that we were on the brink of something. But because of the short record length, it was still really difficult to detect a trend. And so, for instance, at that very meeting at the Royal Society, there was a claim that there wasn't a global wildfire crisis. If you looked at the data, the authors of this paper said you could not see a trend and that maybe this was just confirmation bias or it says more media reporting and so on. Certainly in the last 10 years, there's no question, and it seems to have kicked off at around 2016, we are now officially in a global wildfire crisis. We published a paper last year in Science working with a major reinsurer, and you can see a very strong upward trend in major, like billion-dollar disasters, major fatality events and so on. This is something we can see in the data, but what's probably more alarming, I suppose, is that, fair enough, you can have bad fire seasons in Canada, but we're getting bad fire seasons every other year now. And now we've just seen Europe has had recently bad fire seasons, and we've just seen this epic and still unresolved fire season. So I think that it's now completely fair to say that there is a global wildfire crisis, whereas 10 years ago, it was something that we were concerned about. And there's always different points of view. People could say, you know, you're over-egging it, that there's other ways to think about the data.
The evidence is overwhelming. I mean, if you look at France and Spain and Greece, for that matter,
yeah,
I've never seen anything like it.
Well, absolutely. And the UK, Norway, right up into, in fact, Greenland, Siberia. I mean, the whole thing is going off. But 10 years ago, we didn't have that strength of evidence, and now we do have the strength of evidence. So to a certain degree, what is motivating me for my research now is, well, I don't want to say, well, clever me, I was right. That's actually not interesting. What's interesting is, what are we going to do about it? And that's a very complicated and exciting challenge. And obviously we have to decarbonise and stabilise our climate, but unfortunately, we've baked in climate change. We've got a non-stationary climate. It's not settled. Even if we were able to decarbonise at a very, very fast rate, we're still going to be 2 degrees plus. So we have to adapt. And the adaptation pathways of how do we coexist with fire? And this leads us back to how did Indigenous people live with fire? How can we manage our suburbs, our gardens, our lifestyle, our whole way of thinking about fuel in the landscape, what's socially acceptable, how are we going to deal with smoke? We're going to have to burn some of the fuel. Or what are we going to do if we use mechanical clearing? What are we going to do with this debris? We've got all of these questions that can be a little bit overwhelming if you think about them all at once. But what's particularly nice, I suppose, is that over the last 15 years or so, I've been promoting the discipline of pyrogeography. We now have a journal of pyrogeography. And a pyrogeographic approach is very helpful because it doesn't deny the complexity. It enables researchers, scholars, practitioners to chunk down particular components of the problem and explore possible solutions. And so what's, I suppose, a strange thing which is going on is we're going from this very global perspective of a global wildfire crisis, but it really is like the old saw that think globally, act locally. The pathway out of this mess is local actions. And Hobart is a particularly attractive place to experiment, you know, to do thinning, burning, trying to create marsupial lawns, changing people's gardens, thinking about evacuations, thinking about sheltering in place, thinking about different sorts of fuel management, different sorts of firefighting techniques. Because it's an island, it's a very coherent and well-connected research and management community. It's possible, I think, to make a lot of progress here. And one of the things, a legacy of what I'm doing, is that people will want to journey to Tasmania to look at how we adapted to this very terrifying, fiery future that we've brought upon ourselves.
By the way, what's a kangaroo lawn?
A marsupial lawn. One of the lucky things we have, we don't have foxes here, so we have a lot of small marsupials, and in the right circumstances, they can crop the herbage right down to literally bowling greens. You know, it looks like somebody's gone along there was making a lawn, but they're actually being maintained by the marsupials. One of the things we've got a student just starting on this is that we want to learn more about these lawns. They're very attractive. If we can encourage more of these lawns, they're spectacularly nice fire breaks. They can be self-sustaining. The marsupials are doing the work. There's literally nothing to burn because it's been cropped down to grass, and then you can have around it scattered trees, or you can have what we call green fire breaks through the wetter forests, which have got marsupial lawns. One of the things our research is consistently showing is that you need a couple of hundred metres between your housing, so the suburbs and the city, and the wildlands. And so if we can have that couple of hundred metres, which is not bare earth, but can be biodiverse, have high amenity value, we can basically have it all, and we can really dial down the risk to a conflagration. Because obviously, with things like LA, the question everybody's thinking is, well, will a urban conflagration, and that's when the fire stops being fueled by wildland fuels and it's fueled as houses.
I interviewed someone in LA who is in charge of the Einstein archive, finished interviewing. You know, she was quite serene, a tiny bit on edge. And I said, how'd you go in the fire? She said, my house burned down yesterday. And there she was doing an ABC interview. But when we watch television, we not only see forests on fire and landscapes, but also with war, we've got similar sorts of gigantic black clouds going up in the sky. They must be bad for the health.
The smoke issue in wildfires, one of the extraordinary things in my career, we published a paper in 2001, and at that stage there was literally a handful of papers that had shown a strong link between wildfire smoke or bushfire smoke and human health. Now there are whole conferences devoted to this subject. It's an absolutely huge issue. And one of the reasons it's a huge issue is because so many people are affected. So, for instance, in the 2019-20 fires, the major cause of death from those fires was from smoke, not from the flames. In those fires, it was about half of the Australian population was being exposed to very, very dangerous levels of smoke. So smoke management, this comes back to how do we dial down the intensity of the fires, stop the fires in the wildlands? What are we going to do about wildfire fuel management? How do we remove the fuel, you know, if we're creating smoke? So there's all these really interesting trade-offs between prescribed burning, which can reduce fuels and provide protection in some environments, in some situations, but it produces smoke. And often the most useful place to prescribe burning is right next to where people live in the suburbs. Yeah. So that's why I'm interested in alternative things like marsupial lawns. And if you don't, you know, on the mainland, it's harder because of the foxes, but you can use sheep, goats, all sorts of other innovative ways of possibly irrigating, using wastewater. There's lots of things that we can try to reduce fuel loads, which are going to reduce the intensity of the fires, which will reduce the amount of smoke. So the smoke issue is a massive issue. And there's also, tragically, another and frightening dimension of the smoke issue, and that is, of course, the smoke has a lot of greenhouse gases in it. So as we are burning more and we're having these epic fire seasons, that's contributing a significant amount of greenhouse gas. So the fires in Canada and the fires in Australia produce more greenhouse gases in those fire seasons than through anthropogenic emissions.
Incredible, isn't it?
It is incredible.
David Bowman, Professor of Pyrogeography at the University of Tasmania, speaking at the time of the marvellous Beaker Street Festival. And yes, I still call it the best such festival in the world, involving so many right, across Hobart. And you might have heard their famous debate hosted by Natasha Mitchell and broadcast on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National just last week. Beaker Street also encourages lots of early career scientists to come along, give talks and be advised by communicators such as Tegan Taylor of ABC's Life Matters. Here are some examples. First, Alison Reynolds, who's a hydrogeochemist and covers water issues all over Australia, and was inspired by a mishap involving her father way back.
A hydrogeochemist? I've never met one before, have I?
Potentially, but it's really just somebody who looks at the chemistry interactions between rock and water and rock, particularly in a contamination sort of sense.
I see, but where does your father come into this story?
He gave me a bit of spinach under my duress when I was a bad vegetarian as a teenager, and that spinach actually ended up having a very deadly strain of E. coli that made me very sick. I had kidney failure. I was in the hospital for about 3 weeks. I nearly died, and my platelets were so low that I wasn't allowed to brush my teeth because I might bleed out. They wouldn't be able to stop the bleeding. So truly, it's his fault. But in actuality, what happened is there was an E. coli outbreak in spinach because there was a spinach farm that was downstream of a pig farm, and that pig farm had pig effluent going into the stream that the spinach farm was then irrigating with. And so it caused a big E. coli outbreak in the US, and a few people died. I was very lucky, but it really got me onto wanting to understand contamination in water and how that happens and what to do about it.
You're actually in the US?
Yeah, I was in Ohio, but it was a nationwide outbreak. They sent bits of my blood and tissue and stuff to the CDC to figure out how I had gotten this E. coli strain. And yeah, it turns out that that's what happened.
And how have you adapted that into what you're doing with water these days?
I was always interested in geology. I was a really big fan of rocks when I was a kid. And so when I started to go to university and train in geology, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with it. And then I found out about hydrogeology, which is water within the rocks. And then I started to learn more about surface water, and it kind of helped me understand what happened to me and that it's all one big system. And so I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the challenge that it gave. So I pursued that. It led me to here in Australia to work in contaminated land. And so most of the time I'm looking at contaminated soil and groundwater and surface water across Australia. Honestly, not actually too much with fecal coliforms, which are the things.
PFAS, though.
Yeah, PFAS, the forever chemical. Very sexy name, but also a lot of nutrients and metals as well. And trying to figure out how events like these happen, like how contamination events that impact human health happen. And truly, it's that nobody talks to each other. You know, we all learned the water cycle in middle school and that everything's connected and that the rainwater fills the aquifers, the groundwater, and then that groundwater discharges to surface water, which becomes rain, and then it repeats. But somewhere along the lines, this has been forgotten. In the environmental industry, it just seems like a lot of times with environmental consulting, or researchers or legislators, they're treating geology and the groundwater and the surface water separately, and they're not talking to each other. And that includes legislation where it will regulate groundwater but not surface water, or look at soil and not groundwater. And they're all connected. And I don't know what happened, but I know that these kind of gaps have been causing issues for human health and the environment, and there's got to be something we can do about it.
How do you get water in rocks, though?
So what happens is groundwater is water between grains of soil and rock. So if you imagine a bucket of sand and you pour water into it at the beach, that's what an aquifer is. That's what groundwater is. And when it comes to hydrogeology, you're looking at how the composition of that rock impacts the groundwater. So for example, if you have sand, most of the time it's a lot easier for water to move through that media than it would be something like clay, which is very small. It's often laying in like flat plains, things like that. But then we also have to remember that when we're mining, for example, arsenic, we're mining zinc, things like that, particularly something in like Tasmania, that's coming from the earth. And there's no reason why groundwater couldn't also dissolve that zinc into water. And so it's kind of looking at how the geology both physically impacts water, but also chemically impacts the water.
How did you get on with your father these days?
He actually felt really guilty about the spinach, and he got me a new video game, and he has apologized profusely, but I bring it up at every opportunity I can. But we do get along quite well. I really love my dad. He's a very good dad. He just had a little $200,000 hospital bill blip.
Oh dear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alison Reynolds, a groundwater investigator at the Beaker Street Festival, with a timely reminder of how we need to understand and control water and keep everyone in touch as disasters loom. Another early career festival participant, again with water, was Megan Saunders of CSIRO, and her focus is our coasts.
You've got lots of coastline here to look after. Do you go all over the land here in Tasmania?
So Australia is a coastal nation. 80% of people live within 50 kilometres of a coast. We have the third largest EEZ and seventh largest coastline in the world. So the coastal ecosystems in Australia are really, really important, as they are worldwide, and play a lot of important roles. So providing habitat for fisheries, protecting shorelines for erosion, supporting endangered species and other biodiversity, and playing a really important role in mitigating against the impacts of climate change by sequestering carbon.
And so you'd think that lots of people will be much more careful with their coastline. But when it comes to the seagrasses, as we've said quite often on the Science Show, maybe 40 times more power absorbing CO2 than even tropical rainforests. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, seagrasses are amazing. So they're a true plant that lives in shallow coastal environments. And as you mentioned, they have a super important role in sequestering carbon. Seagrasses don't have quite the charisma, let's say, of coral reefs and some other areas, and they're a little bit lesser known to the public, broadly speaking. But what we do know is that when we lose seagrasses, we lose a lot of the important functions that we actually value as society. And so my research looks at how we do ecological restoration on coastlines in seagrasses, but also salt marshes, mangroves, shellfish, coral reef and kelp meadows, kelp forests, and how we do this at a really big scale so that we help society have those benefits into the future, so that we help the natural environment, and also so that we actually help countries meet national commitments that we are making towards international agreements.
So the countries get in touch with you, Tasmania, as well, do they?
I am a research scientist. I do science to help support decision making. My personal background is in marine ecology and oceanography, so I bring that scientific training to the research, but this question of how we scale up restoration is, there's a lot of scientific components to it, but it's actually a really big societal question.
Give me some examples, a couple of examples of where you've been doing this work recently.
One of the projects that we have underway is about environmentally friendly moorings. And we've had projects in Tasmania and New South Wales, so on the southern and eastern coast of Australia. And this is a really interesting approach because it looks at chain moorings. So most moorings in a marina would be a float with a chain, and then that chain drags around on the seafloor and disturbs the things living on it and the carbon in the sediments. And so the good news is there are engineered solutions to this. There are environmentally friendly moorings or eco moorings or seagrass friendly moorings. And there's lots of different designs, but often they have kind of an elastic component. So the boat on the surface is floating back and forth and stretching that elastic rather than the chain dragging around on the seafloor. While one chain mooring is a pretty small impact on the seafloor, whole mooring fields can cause a fairly big effect. And so it's a potentially a really great solution to damage in estuaries.
So when you talk to the owners about that, are they helpful and willing?
Part of the challenge of converting chain moorings to environmentally friendly moorings is that they're a different kind of system and people might not be as familiar with them. So in addition to the science and engineering that we're doing, I think one of the big questions in future is understanding why people might be reticent to switch over to that and how you could mitigate that.
There's been some talk recently, it erupts every 10 years or so, about exploiting the bottom of the sea, if you like, the ocean. And there's lots of nuggets of minerals there which you can actually pick up. And all sorts of rather responsible people have been saying that, yeah, you can do it without disturbing too much. But do you think it's worth the risk going down to the ocean's bed that way?
As human beings, we've had incredible impacts on natural ecosystems from the mountains to the oceans. And deep sea mining is certainly next frontier in terms of resource extraction. I'm not personally an expert in deep sea mining. I think it's really challenging to restore our nearshore coastal ecosystems, and there would be a lot of science to do to understand what would be required to restore the impacts of deep sea mining.
What's your next project?
One of the things I do as part of my role is I am one of the leaders of the Australasian Coastal Restoration Network. We are a network of over 600 professionals in the Australasia region. And I get a lot of energy and enthusiasm through this role and really bringing people together to try and break down silos and barriers between people or disciplines or geographies or habitats, and to try and just help people work together more efficiently so that we can ultimately do restoration at big scales and help nature and the people who benefit from all the services that our coastal ecosystems have to offer.
Dr. Megan Saunders of CSIRO. And also at the Beaker Street Festival in Hobart was Sinead Nicholson, a postdoc researcher from the University of Western Sydney and the University of New South Wales, also restoring.
Now, when you're doing the restoration and you're finding places where you can plant, where do you look?
We look for hot spots, literally, where it's hot. But we also look for places that don't have the green spaces there already. So it's a combination of environmental and social equity.
And to restore this wasteland, do you actually take part yourself?
I do not.
You don't get your hands dirty?
Not in the research project. We're more about trying to work out what's the most convenient places to plant for heat and flood and fire. So it's not just wasteland, it's also what's going to help protect us as well.
When did you start doing that?
1 year ago. So I started on this project 1.5 years ago.
It takes that time, actually, for things to grow up effectively, doesn't it?
It takes much longer. And actually, I think this is something we should all keep in mind in my field, is a tree takes about 30 to 50 years to be mature enough to provide cooling and all these other benefits. So it's a slow timeline.
So how do you encourage young people to take part in that if they've got to wait so bloody long to get results?
We want to get them involved by just getting outside and planting and learning about the importance of trees and the parks and the bushes. They don't have to be thinking about the big picture. It's just getting out there.
Do they begin to think about the big picture?
They do, and they ask questions and they get interested. They always get interested.
Now, it just so happens the University of Western Sydney has at the Whitlam Institute a project which has been going for 20 years where young people writing 600 words on what matters to me. So many of them had been feeling depressed about, you know, climate change and various other aspects. And that writing, that expressing of concern and saying what matters to them has really turned it round for them, many of them.
Yes, I think what we're lacking, and what a famous architect I don't remember her name, but she said, we are missing utopias. We need visions of the future of what we want it to be instead of talking about how bad it's going to be. I think that's important that to keep in mind in all our projects.
When it comes to feeling better because there's got nature in the city, in the town, have you experienced that yourself, going out for a walk when you're feeling a bit down?
Absolutely. During my PhD, that's how I stayed sane, is getting outside.
Where'd you go?
The mountains. I was living in Italy, so I went to the Alps. I went rock climbing and skiing, or just the next door park, actually.
And you don't mind spending the time with rock climbing? You know, don't just whip around the corner and do it in 5 minutes.
No, it's not exactly a quick activity.
Finally, how much of this kind of work is going on in towns anywhere around the world, making sure that there is some sort of urban natural history?
It's really increasing rapidly. If you look in Europe, you'll see most cities now have like a heat officer and they're talking about urban greening. In Australia also, most cities are introducing urban greening plans, national and city-based plans.
Sinead, thank you, and keep in touch.
Thank you.
Sinead Nicholson from the University of Western Sydney at the Beaker Street Festival last month, one of the dozens of early career scientists attending, showing their commitment, combining good science with effective communication. A great festival in Hobart.
And next week on The Science Show, tag along on a field trip with a couple of botanists as they attempt IVF on a plant. Now, Robin, you'll be away for the next couple of weeks. Where are you off to?
I'm off to Oxford and London.
Oh, beautiful. And what are you doing over there?
recording everyone with a pulse.
Terrific. Look forward to hearing it when you get back.
Thanks.
The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.